I'd like to call to order the Task Force on Class Size for November 21st, 2016. And I would like to find out who we have on the phone in attendance.
Yeah, this is Colin Robinson with the Oregon PTA.
Thank you, Colin.
This is Ann Bryan from Beaverton School District.
Thank you, Ann.
This is Jessica Klassen with David Douglas School District.
Okay. Jeff, did you make it on? And who was the other person we had over there? Was that Jessica? Or it was Ann?
I had Colin was
Colin.
First
okay,
one.
Great.
Yeah, he's on, I think.
Okay, and would you, folks who are here at the dais?
Darren Drell, Superintendent, Cascade School District.
Darren.
Hannah Vandering, Elementary PE Teacher and OEA President.
Brian Reeder with the Department of Education.
And Susan McLean, who's chairing today. So, did anybody else join us on the phone? Okay, so this is an informational meeting, and we're hoping to get a couple of other people who are going to finish their classes and then join us on the phone. And so if you are on the phone, we'll have you introduce yourself as you join. And we're going to go ahead and start off here with a preview of the Senate Bill 1541, which is a report in 2016 to the legislature. And Mr. Reeder, I believe you were going to help us walk through that.
Yep, and I don't have a handout for that because the report's in process and we're not quite there yet. But let me step through the approach we're taking, and then we can talk about it, or I can answer any questions that people might have. The task given to the department in the Senate bill is to look at the variation across school districts in Oregon in how they spend their money on things like instruction, administration, teacher professional development, all those things that school districts do to educate kids. And the ultimate goal is to try and understand whether districts who allocate their resources in a particular way get better results in terms of student outcomes than districts who allocate their resources in a different way. Now, obviously, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of variation across districts and things like their demographics, their funding levels, their circumstances in terms of rural versus urban, and what that implies for certain costs in things like transportation or things that in a lot of cases they don't have control over. Mm-hmm. The way we approach this is to first recognize that every district faces a budget constraint. In other words, they have a certain amount of revenue, and with a few exceptions, they have very little control over that as well. Districts can impose local option levies or construction excise tax. They can try to increase their private donations, but those three approaches represent a relatively small amount of revenue, and most districts have really limited ability to even do those things. And so they have a limited amount of money, and their choices have to do with how they allocate those resources to different uses. And what the budget constraint means is that spending more in one area necessarily means spending less in another. Mm-hmm. And so those are the choices they make at the district level, and maybe sometimes at the school level, but it's really the major decisions are made at the district level. And then the next piece is to recognize that certain activities that districts are that they do are more what I call productive in the sense of enhancing student learning than other activities. For example, more spending on transportation does little or nothing to increase student learning, but it does take money away from other activities that probably do. So if you're spending a really large share of your budget on transportation, and we do have districts in Oregon that spend $2,000 per student just to transport kids. Arguably, that money, if you could reduce that and still get your kids to school safely and on time, redirecting those resources to, say, smaller class sizes, would likely result in enhanced student learning. So our task at the department is to understand which activities enhance learning if you direct more resources there and which don't, and to describe that. And then to look at, try to quantify that, and then also to look at some more specific factors that are identified in the legislation that are thought to enhance student learning, like class size, length of the school year, and probably indirectly compensation levels. And what I've noticed in the data, which I hadn't fully appreciated before, is just how much variation there is in salary levels around the state. And I've looked very closely at teacher salaries. And the variation is almost by a factor of two. In other words, if you look at a given spot on the salary schedule, and the one I chose with a teacher with a master's degree in their 10th year of teaching, because that's probably a typical teacher in Oregon. Salaries vary from slightly below $40,000 a year to over $70,000 a year, and that's just a huge range. So if I'm a district with very high salaries and a given level of funding per student, I can do a lot less than a district with much lower salaries and that same level of per student funding. So that's that concept of, in terms of salaries, what I call the price of buying a teacher, that applies to administrators, it applies to the prices of other inputs as well, like energy, textbooks, but those don't vary nearly as much around the state. I mean, administrators may, but those other inputs don't vary as much around the state as do salaries. Those are a function primarily of the cost of living in the place where, in the area where the school district is located. So that's a key piece that we found. But I think the key point to recognize is that districts have control over certain of their costs, and they don't have control over certain other costs. Certain fixed costs like transportation, heating their buildings, administration, and so forth. There are economies of scale in those so that larger districts can do that more cheaply per student than really small districts. And so there are certain fixed costs that are very difficult to reduce for a school district. And if those are large enough, they diminish or crowd out the amount of resources that are available for the classroom and for other activities that directly contribute to student learning. So that's really the framework in which we're evaluating this. And then really the last piece, and I think the most important and I hope instructive piece, will be to understand how certain allocations, certain choices made by districts, whether those are associated with better outcomes or not. And the ones specifically identified, and this came from the initial question asked by Senator Haas, was how is it that, you know, given the way we equalize funding, that some districts have much higher class sizes than others? How is it that some have much shorter school years than others, given that we essentially have equalized funding? And I think the answer, part of the answer, is choices that districts have made based on their circumstances. And part of it is these fixed costs that are just much higher for certain districts than others. So they are left with less money for a longer school year and lower class sizes.
At this time, I think it's appropriate for questions. I have one as a chair. I'll start off while you're thinking of questions. And if anybody online has a question, please let us know. And please say your name before, and then state your question. So I'm going to start off. And one of the questions that I have is that this report, as you say, gave you some questions and maybe gave you some sideboards. And so some of the sideboards were on the results of conditions in schools, like class sizes or the amount of money spent on different pieces of running a school.
Correct.
From transportation to salaries of staff members to, you indicated even, you know, how much you spend on your heat and how many administrators you have. So what is the criteria that you are using to filter through all that, those sideboards, and all those pieces of running a school besides cost of living?
Well, in essence, we're letting the data speak for itself. We observe how districts spend their money. We observe a lot of student characteristics, demographics, socioeconomic status, racial, ethnic breakdowns. We observe district size, location, and other factors that we know affect costs. And then we basically build a model that tells us which of those have the most impact on the outcomes that those districts get with their students.
So I'm just going to use an example that you already used that I see having effect around the state. And let's use the fact that you've got a small district in a rural area with a commute time of 50 to 60 miles. And then you've got a metropolitan Portland area where you've got a commute time with transit available. How do you let the data speak for itself? And how do you filter, again, the information? Because, I mean, we all know that there's differences on a scale of cost of transportation depending on where you're located. So how does this help us? What does this report do? I mean, what are the filters that are going to help us make sort of sense out of the statistical data?
Well, those factors that you mentioned, where you're located, distances that you transport students, the cost per student of transporting students, mm-hmm. Those, in essence, are the filters that help us understand. Those are indicators of where the resources are allocated. So, you know, the more I spend on transportation, the less I have to spend on to reduce class sizes. So if we observe districts with very high transportation costs and high class sizes, and they're getting worse results with their students than districts with lower transportation costs and lower class sizes, that tells us that to the extent that we can direct resources out of transportation or out of other activities that aren't directly contributing to student learning and into activities that are, then that's beneficial. And the data will tell us what those relationships are, whether more spending in category A is beneficial or not to student learning as compared to spending in category B.
This is fascinating to me because the situation is that as we make these categories of circumstances or filters, and then we also make these categories of what brings the best result from the classroom, if you can't get a student to the classroom, there's access issues. And so it seems to me like it's not black and white as far as, you know, what is actually a condition, because those conditions are going to vary so much from school to school or district to district. And that's why we have local school boards to help with that. So I'm just trying to figure out on a state level how to stay true to the mission of the bill and to the mission of this group that we're in right here, which is we're trying to find ways to make sense of what the true conditions are that bring the best results from the classroom. And that's what this report is supposed to do for Senate Bill 1514 or whatever it is, 1541. But I'm trying to make sense because you're going to be making conclusions, you know, and that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to try and give some guidance on where the conditions should be to be the very best classrooms, the very best learning models, the very best results possible. So I want to make sure that we're on solid ground and that we're not losing access or we're not losing, you know, something in a condition that's created by something like transportation, which is get them into the classroom.
Well, first, I don't think there's anything in 1541 that directs the department to make conclusions in terms of this is best.
Okay.
It tells us to look at those circumstances that are associated with higher learning.
Okay.
And that kind of information comes out of the data and what the data tell us. But I think that this comes up a lot when I talk about transportation costs. People say, well, if kids can't get to school, they can't learn. Well, we're not talking about a binary circumstance of whether they get to school or not. We're assuming they all get to school.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can provide certain services like transportation or administration at a given quality level, getting all kids to school on time safely, and if we can do that cheaper by whatever method, then that frees up resources to do things that are more productive in generating student learning.
And you're assuming that we're not looking for new resources, because there may be a situation where you have to get them to school, they have to be dry and able to learn, and we need more resources, so we have smaller class sizes. This is a scenario. And so the conclusion is not that we have to cut something, that there may be two things that are equally important and we may need both of them. So then what do we do?
Well, the charge in the legislation does not direct the department to look at different levels of funding. It simply says, look at how districts allocate their resources and determine whether certain ways of doing that are associated with higher student outcomes than others.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
This is Ann Bryan. I have a clarifying question.
Thank you, Ann.
Because in a state with as many school districts as we have and who are of such different variety, I'm curious, Brian, if there's an effort as part of your report to delineate sort of like schools. You know, I think Chair McLean referenced, you know, transportation for Portland Public Schools is going to be very different than for Burns Public Schools. Is there, and we would expect their transportation costs perhaps to be different. Is there some effort to, you know, decide, you know, distance from school for students and compare levels of efficiency that way, or is it or even within the classroom itself, different options for programming that is offered and delivered by certified teachers, or is it really just, you know, total dollars spent on teaching and total dollars spent on transportation that you're evaluating?
Well, we don't get to the level of what goes on in classrooms, whether good teaching, bad teaching, this kind of approach, that kind of approach. But we do take into account the differences across school districts. So we take into account the size of the district. We take into account their demographic makeup. We take into account the level of their salaries. We take into account whether they're urban or rural or suburban or in small towns. We take into account as many factors as we can, given the data that we have, that make districts different from one another, so that we can isolate the impact of resources here versus resources there.
And I just want a quick follow-up. I missed, when will this report be available?
December 15th.
Or is there a draft being circulated, or how will we be able to get insight into it?
The report is due December 15th, and so the report is in draft stage right now, but it's not being circulated at the moment for comment.
Will it be?
Probably not widely, certainly not to the public.
Okay.
It'll be distributed within the education community to a certain extent.
Did you hear that, Ann?
I did. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair,
I can't wait.
Correct me if I'm wrong, does the bill language specify if it's turned over to legislators, then it is published on the legislative website as well, the final report? Typically, a bill will say...
Yeah, and I believe it says delivered to the legislature on the 15th.
And it would be available through the legislature's website in that case, and when that happens,
after
the 15th.
Okay, so I think from what I'm hearing there, Anne, is that there's not going to be any circulation for the draft, but then when it's delivered to the legislature, then, of course, we can all weigh in on what we're reading.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank Mr. Reeder for his work there, and I know that he's right in the middle of this report, and so having him come with a preview was really beyond all expectations, I'm sure, and I want to thank you for that. We also talked a little bit about revisiting the QEM staffing suggestions for the higher need children and youth, and were you prepared to do that today?
I am.
Thank you. Is there a way we can get this to folks on?
Yeah, I'll ask Corey to upload it.
Okay. We're going to upload, this is a staffing handout that's being given to us by Mr. Reeder from the Department of Ed, and we're going to get our staff member here to upload that onto OLIS so that hopefully you can see it as soon as possible. And so we will start the conversation, and if you have any questions, hopefully you will be able to see that before you need to ask any questions. Mr. Reeder.
So a couple things I forgot to write on this. These are per school numbers from the QEM, and the QEM uses what we call prototype schools. So the elementary school is 340 students, the middle school is 500 students, and the high school is 1,000 students. So these are, in all but one case, these are additional FTE of teachers or counselors recommended per school above what the schools currently have in Oregon today on average. So these are additional resources. So for example, if you look at the subtitle here, these are in addition to the added teachers recommended strictly for class size reduction. So these are beyond the staffing levels needed to reduce class sizes. Mm-hmm. So these are as you asked, directed towards additional supports for higher needs students. So in elementary schools, what the QEM terms is additional teachers for focused instruction. This is the kind of model that a number of school districts are using where students have fallen behind in their coursework. They'll get additional instruction time with a teacher, sometimes during the summer, sometimes during the regular school year, but outside of regular classrooms to catch them up. It does add an additional, proposes adding an additional week of summer school to every school in the state. Right now, quite a few districts do offer summer school. Some don't. Those that do typically offer about 2 weeks. This would increase that to 3 weeks. It recommends additional English as a second language teachers in both middle and high schools, not in elementary schools. It's probably an issue that the commission should revisit as to, you know, more and more evidence that exiting or becoming proficient in English as early as possible leads to much better outcomes once students get into high school. Mm-hmm. I think these were directed at students who may have arrived in Oregon schools in middle or high school, mm-hmm. and therefore have less time, didn't have the opportunity to learn English when they were younger. Additional staff for special education and alternative education programs in at all three levels of schools. And then additional counselors. If you look at the data over time in Oregon, the number of counselors in our schools has diminished rather dramatically. And so the commission recommends that be increased.
Hannah, did you have a question on that?
I should know this. Just a question on the counselors, additional counselors. What's the current? Is it recommended one full-time counselor at the elementary level?
It's either one or half, and I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
But, yeah, there are counselors. We do currently have counselors in our elementary schools.
Yeah. I think I have the report.
So any questions about this?
Are there any questions either at the dais or on the phone? The areas, and was that you? No. Additional teachers for focused instruction, additional summer school weeks, additional ESL staff, additional special ed and alternative education staff, and then additional counselors were the areas that this was focusing on. Well, I appreciate the information from the staff, and I appreciate folks taking a look at that and maybe coming back, and we can have maybe a further conversation about this near the end of the meeting, or if you want, we can put this on the agenda for the next meeting if there's something there you'd like us to look at more closely as we're making some suggestions or trying to figure out how to deal with sort of relating both to the report that's coming out on December 15th, also on just looking at what the QEM suggests for both classroom instruction as well as additional staff needed for high needs kids. So any of those areas are certainly areas that we can look into as we're making some suggestions at the end of this next meeting or two. So thank you for bringing that, Brian. At this time, we were trying to get a little more information about composition of classrooms, and we talked a little bit about blended classrooms. That was where we talked about last meeting. The idea that there may be either some pluses or some minuses that could actually be there in this area of composition of classrooms. And we were going to invite some folks here, and I believe there are a few folks here that are willing to talk on that today. I don't know where you wrote those. Okay, here we go. So we're going to be asking at this time if you'd like to come up together or separately, it doesn't matter. But we have Mindy, is it Merritt? Okay, and then we have Tyler, and last name is Cecilio. Thank you. Come on up, and you can tell us where you have your expertise, and give us some information on blended classrooms and or just configuration of classrooms.
Right, thank you.
And if you would just give your name and your location for the record.
Absolutely. My name is Mindy Merritt, and I am the president of Salem-Keizer Education Association. This is my 25th year as an educator. I spent the last 16 years in Salem-Keizer. Majority of my time has been in primary, kindergarten, first, and second grade.
Thank you.
And I'm Tyler Skillow-Lakeberg. I'm the vice president of the Salem-Keizer Education Association. This is my 19th year in education, mostly social studies at the high school level.
Thank you very much. So would you like to start?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I just want to say hello to your task force. Thank you for having us. As I said, my name is Mindy Merritt. It is an honor to be able to share with you both my personal experiences and those of my members regarding the social, emotional, and academic impact large class sizes have on our students, educators, and school communities. When I first began my career in education, blended classrooms were the rage. It was a time that was referred to often as the non-graded or mixed age groupings, which had become very popular as a way to address the developmental needs of our students. The blended approach can be powerful when the foundation for learning is based on developmentally appropriate teaching and curriculum practices, which allow individual students to benefit from the cross-age interactions to intellectual and social development. Personally, I have successfully taught a first and second grade blended classroom on several occasions. However, the important thing that I'd like you to know is the components and supports that I had when I was asked to teach those blended classrooms. I was always guaranteed a smaller class size. I had intentional student placement with developmental readiness, academic ability, and social-emotional readiness were considered. At the time, my administrator allowed me to make the professional decisions necessary when combining the two different grade level standards. Additional time was provided to me for planning so that I could ensure that I was reaching the needs of all of my students. Support from my administration regarding parent communications and recognizing the importance of educating our families regarding developmentally appropriate practices and learning were always considered, and that was recognized the importance between the home and school relationships. As you might guess, blended classrooms and the non-graded approach, when they're developmentally appropriately addressed, were really successful. However, I'm here today to share with you that's not necessarily what we see from our members. And as we visit and are out in our classrooms here in Salem-Keizer, it's a concern that we have. Today's educator is often asked to teach a blended classroom either in August or the last week of September, sometimes even the first week of October, being informed that addressing the needs of the large class sizes at that specific grade level, an additional teacher is coming in, and therefore they're being asked to make a change from the grade level they've been planning for, working on throughout the summer, to shifting and creating and incorporating a completely different curriculum and a completely different grade level team. This often comes with a lot of different feelings and emotions because not all parents and students choose to leave the teacher that they bonded with at the beginning of the year. So that can be quite stressful. The educator themselves is being asked to accommodate, and oftentimes will say goodbye to their class that they've started on Friday, and that Monday they'll start with their blended classroom. That's a lot to ask of our students and our educators. No longer is class size a number one caution when looking at a blended classroom. They're there to balance the weight of all the grade levels. And so it's quite common to find 26 students within a blended classroom, which is the same as the regular gen ed classroom, which is concerning. No longer is the teacher allowed to have the professional judgment and incorporate the two curriculums of each grade level into what's appropriate for their specific class. Our teachers are now being expected at the elementary level, we're incorporating ReadyGen, which is a reading curriculum. Our teachers are now being expected to not only teach to their second graders the second grade ReadyGen curriculum with fidelity, which actually takes the full morning. In addition, they're expected to be teaching their first graders to their ReadyGen curriculum with fidelity. And that becomes quite challenging because unlike the theory of the non-graded, which is we come together and we're learning from that multi-age, now you're running two completely different systems under one roof with one educator who's having to not only plan oftentimes in a silo because there aren't often many blended classrooms within the same school. So you are adjusting and they're alternating between the PLCs, the professional learning communities of the one grade level, and then the next week they're jumping over to the other grade level. And so they're lacking that consistency of follow through, which we know is so important for professional learning communities. In addition, I think it's really important to reflect on not only the ask of our educators who we're struggling with right now for retention and the high demands that we place on them both professionally, because in Salem-Keizer there is not a lot of professional development that is specifically focused on a blended classroom. Oftentimes it's a temporary solution. You're informed that you'll be teaching it this year and next year we'll try to get you back to a regular ed classroom. So there aren't the necessary foundational components needed to ensure success. In addition to that, the professional development, the PLCs, just where that teacher belongs. But we also struggle with the behaviors that come in to those classrooms. Our schools right now, kindergarten, first and second grade especially, and I've heard it's across the state and I've even heard it's across the nation, are experiencing some very extreme behaviors. So now you have a blended classroom, two curriculums that you're trying to run side by side with those pressures. And if it's a younger blended classroom, first graders, kindergartners, and a lot of second graders do not have the independent skills that are required to be working independently while the teacher is addressing the other grade within that blended classroom. So that can be a real setup. And I worry about that for our members. Developmental demands, support of the parents, and educating the parents. Really, no time is spent on sharing with the parents, what does it mean to be in a blended classroom? What are the positive attributes of a blended classroom versus a gen ed classroom? And in reality, I question, are we getting the benefits setting our blended classrooms up at this level? And finally, in closing, I'd just like to address and acknowledge that research shows that the impact of large class sizes really does take away from our students and the differentiation that they require to be successful within our classrooms. And when we add, at the last minute, additional grade levels and expectations, that just complicates things even more. And I think, with caution, I say it allows our students to fall through the cracks, which is what we don't want to see. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I will tell you that we are still accepting documents for our literature. And so if you have some favorite reports that you think demonstrates the class size issue that you were just talking about.
Excellent.
Along with all these other challenges. We'd be happy to add that on OLIS so other people could benefit from it.
Excellent. I will
and
do that.
We can get it to our staff right here or to my staff, Nicole.
Okay.
And we'll make sure we get that on.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your testimony. I think we'll listen to our other testifier, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
So thank you for this opportunity. As a secondary teacher, I have a little bit different perspective. So when I'm thinking about the impact on student success for large class sizes, I would say it's minimal. If my students are at average or above average intelligence, if my students are at above average socioeconomic status, if my students come from stable homes with positive parent involvement, if my students have intrinsic motivation, give me a lecture hall, I'll lecture to them, give me 100. They'll do fine. They might not reach their full learning potential, they might not be fully engaged, but they'll pass my class, they'll go on to graduate, most likely go on to college because they themselves come from homes of college graduates. My 18 years as a teacher for social studies at North Salem High School, a Title I school, these are not the students I taught. In my classrooms, I had students of poverty, about 80% or higher poverty. I have students learning English as a second language, students with special education needs, from autism, specific learning disabilities, students with mental and emotional issues, students with very little parent involvement, students that were homeless, coming from foster homes. In an average class size, my experience has been, as a core curriculum teacher, the attempt was to cap at 36 students. So within that class, again, 80% of them would probably be students of poverty. About a third of my class would be English language learners of different levels. And then even then, over half, most likely English not being their first language. About a quarter to a third students of special ed, and then, of course, many others, at-risk students. My classroom starts off with 36 desks. I was fortunate enough to have actually a physically large classroom at North Salem High School. If you go to any of the schools, high schools across the state, especially in Salem-Keizer, you're going to see various sizes, again, with an average of 30 desks put in. If you were to go ask any secondary high school teacher, why are classes smaller at second semester than they are at the beginning of the year, they'll probably give you about the same answer. We lost those kids. So at the beginning of the last year, I'm now out of the classroom this year as I'm serving my members, but even as last year, I had started off with classes of 42, 38, 39, 40. So again, 36 desks. So we shoved kids at my desk. We brought in folding chairs. I had an extra stool. Now, that was for core curriculum classes. Taking in mind the elective classes, often mid-40s or higher. Our PE classes, often 50 now. One of the trends have been the blended classroom at the secondary level looks a lot different. It's not blended grade per se, but multiple subjects in one classroom, specifically for a lot of our elective classes. And a lot of people think, oh, well, that's just art or music, so that's fine, right? What about accounting? Accounting 1, 2, and 3 in the same class. What about French or other language classes? French first year, second year, third year, all in one class. There's also been looking at a trend to start blending honors and regular classes also in the same class. So the classrooms I described, you can imagine the diversity of these classes. And for a regular teacher, how do you meet the needs of all these students? Best practices said that for student engagement, you need to have multiple types of strategies. The best practices, when you get students engaged, student learning, student success goes up. Right? So to do these types of best practices, you need also some physical space. You need space for hands-on learning activities. You need space to create those small groups, opportunity for peer interaction in a structured learning environment. When I had 36 to 40 students in my class, And again, a larger class, which was probably about the third of this class, or this meeting room. There was not the ability to do all the strategies I would like to have done as best practice would have me do because of the physical space. I had kids sitting next to a radiator against the wall because they couldn't have much of a gap, so they risk being burnt every day as our heater comes on. They learned to navigate it because that's just part of being in school. You just don't have your arm go out because it will burn you. The coming in of class, the leaving of class is a huge ordeal just to physically get in. And then again, the limitations of what we know are strategies that our English language learners need, that our special ed students need, that our TAG students need. Teachers are unable to meet those kind of strategies that our students need to be successful. So as we move forward and you think about class size, please think of our students beyond a data point, beyond the averages. These are kids that the ones that I taught are most at risk to not making it to graduation. This is the achievement gap that we talk about. And I can say from the other side of the benefit of small class sizes. I also run a summer school program and have done so for the past 6 years. I'm in charge of the migrant school students, high school students, for the whole entire district. So any student who is qualified as a migrant student, so their parents work in agricultural, the agricultural field, these are the students that are most at risk for academic gaps. They're the students that move around as their parents look for seasonal work. These are the students that miss a lot, not at grade level, and so forth. So the program I have, we do it at North Salem High School, just a central located high school, but we have students from all of the high schools. We have teachers from Salem-Keizer school districts. I'm describing this because we're not going to a different place. We're not using any other type of resources that we don't have available during the regular school year. But what I see are students that I've seen during the school year and then in my high school program become actively engaged. And again, these are some of the highest risk students of our district. And they do so because our average class size is 15. There is no hiding in a corner. There's no becoming just a number. There is interaction that's meaningful. There's opportunity to create a relationship with their teacher, one-on-one instruction. They're forced to be engaged, for lack of a better word. And then they find that they kind of like it, and they do really well. I think of one particular girl who's a teen parent. She's Latina. English was not her first language. She's been in a summer school program for the past several years. Navigates between child care and so forth, gets A's and B's. And I want to stress, our program is 5 weeks long. This is not a summer camp program. This is regular, fitting in one semester of high school actual core curriculum standards into 5 weeks. It is intense. It is fast-paced. But we're actually able to meet those needs of the students because there is the ability to work with them more one-on-one. And so when I think of that one student who flounders during the regular school year, she thrives in our program. And she does so because she gets individual attention. She's not just a number coming into the classroom. She can't hide in the corner with among 35 other or 40 kids. There's no just not being missed. And so that is the experience I've seen, and I've seen that with my colleagues in their type of situation as well. So as you go forward, please think of those students that are most at risk, that need the most from us, and large class sizes does not work for them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the dais or on the phone? Okay, well, thank you, ladies, very much. I really appreciate it. And again, any written work or any reports that you want to put into the literature, sort of, I guess we're trying to gather as much information as possible, and we really would like to have it out there on OLIS so other folks can see what you're hearing and reading.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I have one little thing I forgot to share, and this was about a middle school PE teacher.
So say your name again.
Mindy Merritt, president of SKEA. And this middle school teacher approached me this September and shared her concern because she has mixed blended classes at blended skills at the PE level. Last year she had 62 students. This year she has 55 students. And she just asked, how am I supposed to keep them safe? If there's a lockdown or somebody comes in or if there's an emergency and I need to account for all of these students, I am just one educator. And that has had a profound impact on me in considering the responsibility that we're putting on our members. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here with us today. I'd like to bring to your attention, and folks who are on the phone, I think you can find this on OLIS.
Yes, Madam Chair, and it was distributed to everybody this afternoon.
Okay, so we have a conclusion page here where there was some more information added for part of the rough draft or draft of the report, and this was, we'd love to have you look at it and send information to our committee staff if there's anything you feel does not reflect what we talked about. And we'd like to make sure that we're continuing to give our staff updates on how we think we're doing on the report and on the draft report. And it would be really appreciated. And we realize that you've only had it here while you were paying attention to others that were giving presentations. But if you could take it home, if there's something you'd like to say right now or something you'd like to address, we're happy to have you do that.
And Madam Chair, we are set up to make edits today if anybody...
Okay.
And so, depending on whether or not we got another person on the phone, it did
great.
Sound earlier like somebody might have hung up or...
Did somebody add... hello? I know we should have on the phone... Colin should be there. And
yes,
Anne?
Still here.
Anne? Jessica?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, did somebody else add? Okay, thank you. So, okay, Hannah?
The fourth paragraph in the... In the conclusion, I think we need to, and I don't have the exact words right now, but in the the third line, so compounding for children already disadvantaged and burdened by poverty or race or disability or any combination of these, that I don't think that language is respectful of our students and making sure we're getting at what we want to do. We want to make sure that all students have access, but to say you're disadvantaged, you're burdened by poverty or race, I don't have the exact words, but I would like us to search for another.
So the point is not to put judgment on and have words that put judgment on, but to just identify categories of differences between students or not.
I think more using asset language would be better than than deficit language, which is what this feels like.
Yes.
It has to be turned around a little bit, but I think we can do that.
Okay.
I'm happy to work on it. I don't have the answer right now.
I was
going to
say, if you have any suggestion would be helpful. Any suggestion?
Okay, so we may not do that today, but Hannah's willing to work on it, and anybody else on the committee, or we'll ask folks that aren't if we could put that on as a task. Make sure that we finish next, before next meeting.
And we are continuing to experience like every technical difficulty you could imagine today between
okay.
the two meetings I've had. It scrolled suddenly, but it may be that I'm out of range or so
okay.
I wouldn't be able to do this in meeting, it looks like, anyway.
So, folks on the phone, we're having some technical difficulties with our technology today. And so even though we have some of the language up on our screen, we're not necessarily able to edit. And so we will continue to work on this. And if you could again send suggestions to our staff, I'd really appreciate it.
Madam Chair, I had one just clarifying question about
yes.
the draft that we received.
Yes.
There were parts that were highlighted. I wasn't sure if those were still under review or if you were just trying to draw our attention to the fact that they were the latest changes.
There were three highlighted sections, I believe. Two are pending potential language. Just adjust it again.
Right. So,
and one of them was the addition of the last piece of the percentages that were on page 6. So two of them are open spaces where pending language may be pending, and one of them was just a new statistic, a new
percentage that folks hadn't seen yet. So I wanted to make sure that it didn't get overlooked if anybody wanted to comment on it.
And that was actually added because it was left out of the other report.
That's right. We closed our previous meeting.
Yes.
The information trickled in, and I made the changes. So that's the last bit of information to come in.
So, Anne, that was a good comment because it basically we're asking you to look at that and see if you find that language to be doing the job we need it to do. If not, again, comment and sending that information to the staff would be great. We do not have a quorum at this time. I think we're one short on a quorum. And so we're not going to be making actual decisions on that. We can continue to work on it and continue to get information to the staff, but I'd love you to verbalize anything that you have. So, Darren?
On page four, can we add that I'm actually at a specific school district, since others say that, so can it say Cascade School District, other than just district?
Yes.
Superintendent?
Absolutely.
Somehow I missed that last time.
Thank you for finding that.
No, it's okay.
Susan, this is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
So I just heard you were one short of quorum, and when you're going through the roll call of who's on the phone, I don't know
he's
if you
your
actually heard me come in or not, or I'm trying to get it. I need eight.
Okay. So, Jeff, thank you so much for acknowledging yourself, and thank you for being on the phone with us. I appreciate that. So we just made one correction on a title. We also just had a suggestion from Hannah that we need to work on taking out some deficit language and really looking for some better, more positive frameworking there on language on the fourth paragraph on the conclusion page. And right now our technology is working, so if anybody comes up with suggestions, we might be able to get it on the screen. So is there anybody on the phone who would like to make either a comment or ask a question about the draft report? Well, I would like to make just a couple of comments as the chair of this task force to try and move us maybe into a little bit of a dialogue right now, or at least into pre-shadowing a dialogue we should be having at the next meeting. Besides making sure that we're satisfied with the report, we made some comments, and I know I personally made some comments, that the last section should be a little heftier, a little meatier, as far as suggestions and or ideas or concepts that we think are valuable for us to give back in the way of a report to the legislature. We know that we are in a crisis budget setting. We know that our very slim resources are going to have to be spread even further than we've had to spread them in the last 20 years. And the next two sessions or dialogues of budget are going to be very painful. And we also know that we have the voters who have voted in three more responsibilities or programs that they would like to see us work on. And so really and truly, any suggestions that we can make or any coalition that we can build around that's going to help with what really brings better results in our classroom. And we heard today from two former educators and our current educators that class size does make a difference in the abilities of a teacher to be able to do excellent work with a variety of students and a variety of skill needs. We want to do the best we can to really make sure we've got a proactive and a bold statement. So I'm really looking for support from this committee, both on the phone and at the dais, to really consider what are some of the things that we can do that are going to help us be successful in the state of Oregon, in our school districts, and in our classrooms for our students. And you folks, many of you sitting on the dais and also who are on the phone, are the experts. You are the people in the field. You are the people on the front line. And I think it's really important for us to take this opportunity that we're creating with this report to give some feedback to both the Department of Education as well as the legislature. So again, that's kind of my persuasive speech for the day, but I would really love to have anybody online or on the dais give comments toward that goal.
Okay.
Susan?
Yes.
This is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
So I'll put something out there that I don't know, maybe bold or not. But what if there's some kind of indication towards making class size language in contracts mandatory subject to bargaining kind of parameters versus what we currently have?
So the suggestion is that we talk about class size as one of the negotiable items in contracting. And Jeff, one of the comments that I would make is we have a history on when it was and when it wasn't, I do believe, in the state. And so we might ask staff to make sure that we, and maybe Hannah as well, that we could get some support by, if we're going to make a suggestion like that, to talk about maybe the history of that and maybe some of the challenges as well as some of the pros and cons on making it a negotiable item. And rather than a suggestion. And I agree with you. I think it's a good idea to put on the table, Jeff. But those are some of my responses, and I'd like to see some responses from others.
On the suggestion?
Yeah, yes. Mr. Reeder?
I guess my view on that is that it only helps if it forces the legislature to devote more resources to schools. And in the meantime, it potentially creates chaos. So I don't support this task force making that recommendation unless it's tied to additional revenue.
Could you hear that, Jeff?
I did.
Okay. Any other comments, please, or any other suggestions?
On the suggestion? Everybody's looking my way. Thanks. I guess, Ms. Darren Drill, Superintendent, I guess my comments obviously would be something different than that, purely because Mr. Reeder pointed out, I think, probably the most difficult part of it, which is, and I think our guests actually said it out loud, which is if you have specific types of kids in certain classrooms, class size isn't necessarily an issue. The trick is, what kinds of kids do you have in a classroom? So you can have an AP classroom with potentially 35 to 45 kids in it, and it runs very smoothly. And I think our guest even suggested that today. Now, the reality is very few classrooms look like that. I understand that. So that's the difficult part of it. At the same time, I would agree with Brian in that if there's not attached funding to go with it, you end up handcuffing districts depending on their situation as to how that's going to work. And ultimately, you could have a class size requirement that requires districts to hire more people, which we have issues with already about finding highly qualified staff to work in those areas. And then secondarily, making sure that you have the building, the heat, the lights, and everything else to go with it. There are hard choices to make. The reality is, if you want to make a comment from my perspective, you say it again, which is this is we are underfunded over and over. I continue to feel like we continue to fight for the small piece of cheese that's left. And when we should be working together, right, to make education better, we end up getting divided here at these moments about funding versus class size versus other things. That's a frustration for me.
Well, I'm going to agree with both of you because I think that having the superintendent speak to the issue of we're underfunded and that if we want to get to the real work in the classroom, that we have to acknowledge the kind of students in the classroom and we have to acknowledge the responsibility and the job of the teacher. And maybe we don't say that that it's a contracted item, but maybe we say we need to have more funding to do that same job, whether it be contracted or not.
I think your quality education model speaks to it, right? There's a number of teachers for a certain number of students that kind of solves the problem without having to go into some sort of a conversation or a debate about whether or not that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. That would be my perspective because it answers the question without having to have that battle.
Yeah. Yes, please, yeah. Hannah.
So Hannah Van Ring, Madam Chair, I would just say that for years we've had districts arguing over how we fund our schools because we haven't been given the adequate funds that we need in order to provide a quality learning environment for every student. So we've had to make really tough choices, and we've done a disservice as the adults in this state to all of our children. And so I would say this task force needs to make the strong recommendation, and then we look to the legislature to actually fund, and the governor to actually fund what we need to have in order to ensure that all students have a learning environment where they get the one-on-one attention that they need to succeed. Short of that, obviously the community doesn't trust the legislature, the community doesn't trust us to make good decisions, and we need to actually provide that funding. The quality education model outlines what a school should look like. We've known it for years, and we continue to underfund in a great way. So I would hope that we would make it a priority to actually fund class size. Short of that, I agree with Jeff. It needs to be bargainable, because I'll tell you, the parents in our communities want class sizes reduced, period. They are tired of having their children in classes that are too large, and educators are doing all they can, but we just can't meet the needs of students in those conditions. So
I thank both of you for those comments, because I think that helped round out and kind of circle the, and Mr. Reiter, I thank you for yours. Reiter, I thank you for yours as well. It's a situation where we've got a logistical issue, we've got a service issue, we've got a resource issue, and we've got an outcome desire. And so it's important for us to try to figure out how we deal with those three areas of actual functioning school and districts in our state, and actually get to the conditions that we need to improve and get to the results that we want to have. So I thank you for your comments. And Jeff, thank you for starting that off. We definitely have, and we'll have in the minutes, two suggestions. One, yours, dealing with it as a contracted issue, and two, others who have suggested that there are issues there that we need to discuss. Do we want it to be that form of a debate, or do we want to just acknowledge that we're underfunded and we need to go forward with more funding for our schools in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ann?
Yes, I'm looking at the conclusions, and I guess I have just one thought in terms of the acknowledging that we're underfunded. I very much hope that our report has a very specific ask in it about what we think is required in order to provide, you know, the next steps in achieving better outcomes for our students, which we believe is smaller class sizes. So right now, my concern in the report is that it looks like we're recommending, say, $361 million to get to appropriate class sizes for elementary schools. And I believe that is not sufficient, because even just getting maintaining effort is going to take more than that. So whatever the total really is in terms of maintenance of effort plus whatever it would take to get to elementary school class sizes that were in line with the QEM, that's the number that I would like to be associated with this report, because I think that'll be the key takeaway from the report, that we are looking for a certain level of funding, and I don't think $361 million is it if we're taking into account our other maintenance of effort issues and things like that at each district.
This is Brian. That the $361 million is the amount above what's required to maintain current services. So I think it is the right amount, as long as we explain exactly what it is. It's the additional amount above what current service level is. No matter what current service level is, it's above and beyond that.
I guess I would be interested in having the current service level number there in addition, and then, you know, just so that we're all very clear when we come out of it what we're talking about here.
Okay, that was a suggestion that I think we can do, right, Brian?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so we'll put that in there, too. And anybody else that wants to look at the number, the comment that was made, and it's on the table for the report, is basically that we're very specific, that we're making a comment about being underfunded and then specifically saying how underfunded we are. So we're going to probably have dialogue on that number, and there are probably some little bit of difference of opinion on that number, but it would probably be a good idea for you to get suggestions back again to staff on what we should be discussing next meeting on, you know, any of those issues around this conclusion page or the number amount or the underfunded amount, because we're going to have this meeting. We, you know, you guys guaranteed me two meetings, and so this next meeting is going to be just a, it's going to be a barn burner, and I hope you, we'll make sure you get something to eat too. So we'll figure that out. I'll host. You guys have to be here though to get the food. I'm not delivering.
Heard.
Okay.
This is Colin.
Yes.
You know, we've given the legislature this way out of funding the quality education model. We know what it's going to take in this state to fund education. And as long as we've given them a way out, they're going to use it. And I think we really need to look strongly at removing that, the ability to give them that way out. I think Hannah spoke probably much more eloquently than I could. As the parent, the frustration level is growing at a rate that I don't know how to deal with. And so I'm kind of tired of hearing why we can't fund it when we should be. So I'd like to see us push that the quality education model is there for a reason, and we should be fully funding it.
Thank you for that comment.
Colin, I have a follow-up question. So are you suggesting that perhaps this report might include a recommendation to update the legislation to take the option of providing a report out of the legislation as a sufficient option?
I think that might be a step in the right direction. I think it's something that we should discuss.
Just to be clear, it's in the Constitution, not in just...
It's a constitutional thing, so...
It's a little harder.
So
the legislature could refer that, right? I mean, isn't that how we make changes to the Constitution?
Well, we could make it... I mean, if that's in the Constitution that we have to have at least have a report, the legislation suggestions could also say you can't just have a report. I mean, the Constitution says we have to have a report. That's a minimum.
Well, what it says is that Oregon has to fund schools to the level of the QEM or write a report that says why they can't.
Okay, well, now I really dislike that language.
There's a comma and an or.
Is there a comma?
Comma and an or.
A comma right. And an or. Okay, I agree with Colin. We need to discuss this further, so write down comma and or. We need to talk about that because you're right. That's why we've had a report for 12 years. Yes.
Just to go back quickly, Brian Reeder's comment about CSL, that level, there's a couple of numbers that float around there, and it would sure be nice if we could get from the Oregon Department of Education what they believe the new level would be. Came from the legislative office, that number, COSA, Federation of Oregon School Administrators, believe that number is much lower than it should be. Mm-hmm. And I would sure be nice if we could have Oregon Department say this is what the roll-up cost probably could be or should be. We just got done with our meeting last week, and looking at that initial roll-up number seems very on the light side as to what it would cost to continue. In light of OEBB costing 6, 7, 9, 12% more and other things going up in costs, that's not even about the conversation with regard to working with our associations after the downturn in the economy. That's what we need to do. But that CSL number needs to be something that's more realistic.
That's actually from Department of Administrative Services.
Yes, and we still agree that that's not high enough.
Okay.
So can we...
I know, I get that maybe from there, maybe that's not the right place, but if you start with a CSL that's too low, then you're in the same boat once again. I'm just saying maybe we need to take a look at what CSL really is.
So I'm asking my staff to put that on her list as well for us to really get in and kind of look at that number. And I need support from others to try and help us with that. We have to be able to defend what it is.
Sure.
Madam Chair, just as a suggestion, if a smaller subgroup, not a quorum, sort of like a subcommittee, it'd be a subgroup of the task force, wants to tackle the question, what is that number, in time for you to prepare the task force report or add it to the report, there might be volunteers for that. And taking for granted, is there any objection to the recommendations people made? The only disagreement I've heard so far are about whether or not it should be a bargainable issue. But in terms of an acknowledgement in the report, the task force wants the legislature to acknowledge the chronic underfunding. They want the QEM. They endorse, wholeheartedly endorse the QEM model. They believe that the QEM model should be funded. And the further recommendation that the language should be changed in the Constitution to prohibit the legislative out. Those are the recommendations I heard. If unless there's disagreement, it's just about filling in the blank. What do you think that number is, and recommending what you think that number is. Did anybody disagree?
Well, we had a disagreement a little bit, right?
About the number?
Well, not about the number so much as about, well, on the bargaining, right?
On the bargaining was the major disagreement.
Yeah.
Whether that should be included as a task force recommendation. But I could also write in the report, the task force did not agree on this recommendation, but
it should be
discussed.
It should definitely be in there. It should be discussed. Anybody else? Want to add to that?
So I want to add one more thing in sort of an extension of what Colin said is, instead of simply saying we need more money for schools, I would advocate for recommending that the legislature address tax reform.
Well, I think that's going to be on everybody's list, starting with the governor, because we're in the middle of this meeting, but tax reform, I don't know if we should be that specific or if we should simply say must address new revenue sources, because I think we should.
Well, that would be okay too, but to simply say schools need more money, we've been saying that for a decade and a half, and it's not gotten better.
So do you guys feel good with the tax reform language, or do you feel better with must address new resource systems or new resource sources? Or
I would say revenue.
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 Dance around the real issue.
Okay. Anne?
I was trying to remember as a school district, we have long, you know, I don't think it's surprising to know that we've talked about this issue many times, and usually we've kind of come to this middle ground language that says that, you know, we recognize we need the additional funding, and we're open to all options for how we achieve it, including looking for additional revenue or something like that.
Okay, we've got that down. We need to talk about that. We need to decide if additional revenue is another outward, maybe, or an outphrase or something. Maybe with a number it's not. Anybody want to comment?
So additional funding, and Brian's right, we've been saying it forever and a day, but I think you have to continue to say it over and over and over again. So while I heard my colleagues say that there are people that don't trust the legislature, I heard my colleagues say that nothing has ever changed. Maybe I'm a little bit of a glass half full kind of guy, but I am going to go into this session asking the legislature to once again fully fund the QEM. And without it, you will not get the kind of schools that you say that you support.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all the other stuff's fantastic. I think it ought to be in there. But at the same time, you have to continue to say it. Sometimes I think we say it too nicely. From an administrative standpoint, I'm beginning to start to take a page out of Hannah's book of plays over there, which makes much better sense to me. I am beginning to get very frustrated to try to help our students, particularly rural students, do something different with their life and then continue to complete the same cycle that their parents did. And to do that requires our legislative leaders to put money there. I get that the money is short. I understand that there are choices to be made, but there are choices to be made. And while that's very difficult, those choices are a requirement if we plan on helping to serve kids. So, you know, the money along with the other stuff, I still think you have to say it in there. I think Ann's comment about, you know, how much is the CSL roll-up plus the $361 million just for elementary is a nice start. Mm-hmm. But there needs to be a very clear set amounts of money to address this specific issue, which I think is what we're required to do, right, to talk about this issue itself.
So there was a suggestion made by staff that if there are volunteers, a small group of folks that would like to discuss more the number itself, what the actual realistic number is to get the results that we're talking about with the QEM, right? That if you would like to help us with that, maybe you could let us know either today or soon. And we can maybe, even if we have to do a phone conversation or something, that would work out for a small subgroup.
Yeah, this is Colin. You can put my name on that list now.
Okay, thank you.
I'm also interested in being on that conversation. Okay. This is Ann.
Thank you, Ann.
And if we can do it via teleconference or phone, I'm happy to volunteer.
Okay,
to do
so
it.
Hannah is suggesting she will, and we have another one as well over here. This is working out very well. So thank you very much. And Darren, did you add Darren to the mm-hmm. list? Okay, this is great. All right, so staff will be doing some work to make sure we can get together for a conversation, and we'll try to get some information so we can have a decent conversation about what this should be and bring your own expertise and background.
Okay. This is Jeff. Where are we on that whole notion of the word tax in this report and the conclusion or maybe a strong statement? Is that something where, I mean, is it still a conversation or is it pretty much a...
I'm going to let staff repeat what she has put down, and we can check that.
Madam Chair, the members, the last remark in that train of thought that I've got, and of course this is all subject to, was from Ann, that the broader recommending to the legislature that they examine any additional revenue source versus open to all options for additional funding, something along those lines, and that would include tax reform without using the words tax reform. But you could say, comma, such as tax reform as well.
I also heard that the statement was that we have to tie it to what the goal is, which is to carry out the QEM, and that we have, you know, that what we're doing is we're taking the suggestion of how we get there, you know, from this report that we've all agreed to. Does that answer that, Jeff?
Yeah. I would just put myself on the record to say, you know, prior to the election, we hinted around the opportunity that Measure 97 could present with its passage, and I think that you know, by vote, the outcome obviously was different, and yet, you know, it does speak to the legislators to do something, and tax reform is a pretty big and broad, and I'm not opposed to that phrasing in there somewhere.
Okay. Anybody want to respond to that, or are we kind of at the point where we know we're going to put in there that the goal is carry out QEM, and that we're going to talk about we need additional resources and money to do that, and we'll wordsmith a little bit the language on if we're going to say revenue, if we're going to say tax reform or additional sources or whatever we're going to say as far as our list. Does that sound fair? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I really want to thank the members who have stuck with us both at the dais and on the phone. You guys have been really, really very, very loyal, and I appreciate you carrying out the responsibility of being on the task force. We tried to break the two meetings up in a way that we spent now basically an hour and a half, an hour and 35 minutes. And this next session, I hope that we can, you know, maybe stick in there for a couple hours to try and make sure we can finish the work that we're saying we're going to finish, you know, in this next meeting. And we all know that if we can make a statement, it can be a bold statement. Well, then this hopefully will be part of the conversation as we come into this session to really look at ways to carry out the QEM. And we need folks from all of your venues and all of your professional groups to really assist us in carrying out this message. I think there was also some confusion about adding additional responsibilities by the voters, in my mind, without the actual additional resources. And so I think we have some conversations and some education to do there as well, because again, we're just simply taking a pie that is supposed to feed, you know, many, many people, and keep adding additional responsibilities and more people, but we don't add any additional pie. And so I think it's going to be important for us to get that message and that feeling out there for people to chew on. So any other comments for the good of the order? And I believe our next meeting is going to be December 6th. Is that right?
Forgive me, Madam Chair, I have more than one task force, and I hesitate to commit. Is it?
I think it's December 6th.
My other one must be
on
the
15th. And what time is that?
It's at 3:30 also, and it's back in 3:43, your regular room upstairs, which is a little more conducive.
Right, it is.
Circle.
It helps. I went up there today, and I found out that Senator-elect, Lou Fledrick was up there, and also I think Senator Dembro was up there.
That's the reentry task force that met today.
Yeah.
They got the room just ahead of you folks.
So we'll be back up in our favorite room on the third floor. So anything else for the good of the order? Well, I want to thank you for your time today, and we're going to conclude, and thank you for being here. The meeting is adjourned. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you for being here.